This is the Unconquered Podcast on Seminole Sports Radio, part of the VSporto Network, bringing you all Noles all the time.
At Florida State, we won national championships and ACC championships.
Back to the basics, consistency in what we're doing. Guys getting rolled banged and bruised, working a bunch of different situations, making progress.
You have to have success so you know something, I can really do this.
This is the Unconquered Podcast on Seminole Sports Radio. I'm your host, Jason Staples. Going to talk today at some length more about some philosophical stuff, particularly after all of the Groundhog Day type criticism that we're seeing of Florida State's offense and more in general, not specific stuff about performance, but in general about how Florida State runs offense and plays offensive football under Jimbo Fisher. I'm going to divide this into two segments. One, we're going to take a look at one of my favorite philosophical principles for understanding how to make intelligent critiques, or a prerequisite, that is, for making intelligent critiques. And then we're going to talk more generally about, or more specifically, I guess, about Jimbo Fisher's philosophy on the offensive side of the football and why so many of those critiques miss the mark. I want to start by talking about a principle that guides so much of the way that I think, and something that I think is a very important principle for living an educated life and for doing any sort of good analysis or having something valuable to say or do in terms of criticism, suggestions across life. Now, that principle is generally called the principle of Chesterton's fence, or the fallacy of Chesterton's fence. It's named after the 20th century prolific writer, the Englishman, G.K. Chesterton, who talked about this principle as an important principle for reformers in particular. The basic principle goes like this. Don't ever take a fence down until you know the reason why it was put up. So that's the summary. Don't ever take a fence down until you know the reason it was put up. Now, in the larger picture, it comes from this passage, and I'm going to go ahead and read it in full, because this really does help summarize so much of what I think is going on with a lot of fans in particular, but fans and media and so on who criticize, and this is not about Florida State specifically, but when you see criticisms of coaches and other characters or decision makers, and this is not even limited to sports, but I see it probably most often in sports and most often in football in particular, where you see criticisms of play calling this way. I'm going to go ahead and read this passage because it deals with a lot of those things. And I'm going to add a couple comments in there, here and there, while I read it. So, Chesterton says, in the matter of reforming things, as distinct from deforming them, there is one plain and simple principle, a principle which will probably be called a paradox. There exists in such a case a certain institution or law. Let us say, for the sake of simplicity, a fence or a gate erected across a road. The more modern type of reformer goes gaily up to it and says, I don't see the use of this, let's clear it away. To which the more intelligent type of reformer will do well to answer, if you don't see the use of it, I certainly won't let you clear it away. Go away and think. Then, when you can come back to me and tell me that you do see the use of it, I may allow you to destroy it. This paradox rests on the most elementary common sense. The gate or fence did not grow there. It was not set up by somnambulists who built it in their sleep. It is highly improbable that it was put there by escaped lunatics who were for some reason loose in the street. Some person had some reason for thinking it would be a good thing for somebody. And until we know what the reason was, we really cannot judge whether the reason was reasonable. it is extremely probable that we have overlooked some whole aspect of the question if something set up by human beings like ourselves seems to be entirely meaningless and mysterious. Now, there are reformers who get over this difficulty by assuming that all their fathers were fools. But if that be so, we can only say that folly appears to be a hereditary disease. But the truth is that nobody has any business to destroy a social institution until he has really seen it as a historical institution. If he knows how it arose and what purposes it was supposed to serve, he may really be able to say that they were bad purposes, or that they have since become bad purposes, or that they are purposes which are no longer served. But if he simply stares at the thing as a senseless monstrosity that has somehow sprung up in his path, it is he, and not the traditionalist, who is suffering from an illusion. I think that's brilliant. And the base concept here is you have no business criticizing something or demanding change until you understand the rationale underlying that thing. So if we want to apply this then to football, and you talk about the way that I tend to approach my criticism of various decisions or different things in terms of football. So whether it be play calling or game planning or use of personnel or whatever, I always come back to this principle. Unless you understand the purpose or the reason that something was being done in the first place, you have not only no business, but no real ability to criticize the decision. So, for example, if you see a team run something on offense that just fails miserably, and you just immediately jump to, what a terrible play call. How could they call that? I don't understand why anybody would call that play in that context. Odds are you are the one that's missing something. Odds are the critic who doesn't understand it doesn't get what's going on well enough to actually be a good, intelligent critic. All that goes to say that, generally speaking, it's true. Most fans and most media, in my experience, have no idea what's really happening in terms of the X's and O's and the chess game that's being played on the football field. They see results, and then they make judgments, generally snap judgments or hot takes, on the basis of results alone. But they don't generally get to the why of things. Why was this decision made? Why did X coach choose to do Y in Z situation? Why? Because when it comes down to doing good criticism and actually having something valid to say beyond recognizing this didn't work, which that actually is the sum total of what most criticisms actually amount to, their tautologies, saying that didn't work, it was a bad play call. And by bad play call, they mean it didn't work. It's a tautology. But good play calls can completely fail and not work depending on execution. Everything in football depends on execution. If you want to do good criticism, if you want to have something valid to say, you have to start not with the outcome. The outcome is secondary. And you hear Jimbo Fisher talk about this all the time. You hear Nick Saban talk about this all the time. And actually, you really hear just about any coach, John Wooden, talk about this all the time, that outcome-based thinking is a bad thing. It doesn't work. Outcome-based thinking generally leads to bad outcomes, whereas process-oriented thinking is much more likely to lead to good outcomes. It's not that you're actually ignoring outcomes. It's just that outcomes are treated as a secondary thing. And as to that, I go back to one of my favorite quotes from C.S. Lewis, who was also influenced heavily by G.K. Chesterton. And that principle is, put first things first, and we get second things thrown in. Put second things first, and we lose both. That's a brilliant insight. It really is. And basically, when it comes back to talking about process-oriented versus outcome-oriented thinking, when you start with the outcome, you're starting with the second thing. And this is why you hear Jimbo Fisher talk about, it's not about winning. When you have players who are trying too hard to win, you have problems. And this is, again, this gets back to something I've criticized in the past, where you have this idea that, well, if somebody failed, they just didn't want it as much as the other guy. No, oftentimes it's the reverse. Oftentimes the person who wants it too much is the one that loses. The one who puts the second thing, the outcome, first, loses to the person who's just doing what's necessary to produce that outcome. The focus needs to be on the why and the what need to be done in order to get more consistently good outcomes. The outcome is a secondary thing. What you have to understand is how to get to that secondary outcome and then focus on those things. That's where good criticism of game planning and play calling and these other things come in. And it doesn't start with that failed or that succeeded. It starts with understanding the principles engaged in things from the front side. So to me, if you need to know the result of the play in order to assess whether or not the play call was good or bad, then you have no business criticizing the play call one way or another, because you don't understand the processes that actually have to go into whether a call is good or bad. So let's put this in another way. A lot of people on social media and other places have criticized Jimbo Fisher's decision to run the toss sweep out of the bunch formation on 4th-and-1 against Clemson this week. I'll tell you right now, that was a good call. It's not necessarily what I would have called. I know what I would have called in advance based on what I'd seen from that defense. I probably would have called, if I'd had it prepared, and I don't know if they prepared it over the course of the week, but I probably would have called the fake to the fullback belly and a toss outside to Dalvin Cook running outside. But my call might actually not have been a better call. That's what I was thinking before the play. And again, when I criticize play calling, I'm thinking about what I would have called in the same position, not knowing the outcome of the play. I'm always trying to do it without hindsight bias. And when I go back, and when I went back and I looked at the tape of that play, that fourth down play against Clemson, when you see it, you had a tight end who totally whiffed on a block, and it was actually not a difficult block. All he had to do was just get a little piece of the defensive end, but he stepped inside and took a bad angle, and I still don't know how he didn't touch him. Tight end whiffed on the defensive end, and if he doesn't whiff there, that play goes for at least 3 yards. So if we're just looking at the process of things, it was actually just in terms of lining up what Clemson was in defensively, what Florida State was in defensively. All you needed was all the players were in the right position to actually make that a success. One guy missed an assignment that was actually a pretty easy assignment. That's generally a good indicator that you have a good call. It's something that it just takes routine execution from your offense, from your players, to get a successful outcome. That's one way to assess that. Another way to assess it is that Florida State's biggest success, particularly in the second half running the football, had come on that play, out of that formation, against a look very similar to what Clemson brought out. So, I mean, if you're going to try to go for it on fourth down, you might as well use what's been working. And again, that was very close to working just as well as it had earlier in the game. It's just one example. But normally what I see on social media is people coming in and saying, I just don't understand, you know, why didn't Jimbo Fisher run more screens? You know, they were getting pressure on the quarterback. Just run screens. Well, again, you have to understand that you can't just run screens whenever there's pressure on the quarterback. You have to assess why there's pressure on the quarterback. If you're just running screens against a four-man rush, and even against a five-man rush in like a fire zone or a match coverage, it may not work. And in particular, when Florida State ran some running back type, some running back throws, in, you know, an initial screen earlier in the game, it turned out that Clemson had a linebacker and a safety committed to the running back to prevent Florida State from being able to do any damage with running back screens, at least. And because they're pressing the receivers, it's not like you're going to be able to throw receiver screens all that easily. So that stuff's out. You have to consider what's actually being done in order to criticize what's actually going on. You can't just say, as some did, you know, responding to some of this to some of this stuff on Twitter, you know, Jimbo Fisher had a quarterback below 200 yards passing. Clearly, the play calling should have been better. Well, geez. You know, if you put my wife out there behind center to throw the football and then complained about the play calling when she had under 200 yards, clearly you're missing something. It's about personnel in that case. And in this case, again, it was about personnel. Sean McGuire came close on a couple occasions, but he just didn't make the throws necessary to go over 200 yards. I mean, last year he went over 300 yards, threw for a touchdown, one touchdown, two interceptions for over 300 yards, and his performance was more or less the same type of performance that he put out there this week. Only difference is that on one deep ball, Rashad Greene ran a great route, caused Mackenzie Alexander to fall down, and walked into the end zone for an easy touchdown. But McGuire didn't look a whole lot different in that game, and statistically wasn't really any different, other than that one play, which was pretty fortunate, and also the result of having a senior stud wide receiver who just made a play. Personnel. It's all about personnel. The other part about this is that, yes, in any given game, there are a handful of play calls that I look at and I go, yeah, I'm not really sure I like that particular call. It's not what I would have run there. But generally speaking, you got to understand that play calls are made during the week. And they're made on the basis of what weaknesses have been seen on tape. They're made on the basis of what formations you've prepared all week, based on what weaknesses you've seen on things that you can attack on your own personnel, what they're capable of doing. And you have 15 seconds to make that call on the basis of your chosen down distance stuff and what you expect them to do and different things like that. So, you know, if you're going to get a handful of calls at each game that, yeah, you know, I might have gone a different route with that, that's fine. That's normal. Anytime you have a play calling problem, when you're talking about a play calling problem, a true play calling problem is really a systemic issue. And that's where you don't have an offense that's putting its players in the best positions to succeed. And that has not been the case from the start under Jimbo Fisher at Florida State. Fisher's offense is predicated on putting his offense in the best possible position. And it's predicated on adjusting to personnel. We'll talk a little bit more about that and lots of misconceptions about Jimbo Fisher's offense, to which we can apply Chesterton's fence in just a moment. Welcome back to the Unconquered Podcast. This is your host, Jason Staples. We're talking about some philosophical stuff on this podcast today in the wake of a loss to Clemson, second loss for Florida State this season. And we've seen Florida State's offense continue to struggle on the road, where they've only scored one touchdown in any of their road games all season. Not the best offensive performances over the course of the season. Now, this has led to I feel like I'm in Groundhog Day, given the nature of the discussion that I'm seeing among Florida State's fans. I feel like I'm right back in 2012 with the same misguided and often ridiculous arguments being made. Lots of people calling for Jimbo Fisher to give up play calling or to change his offense, to do this or to, you know, to do that, complaining about Fisher's offense because it, you know, needs a great, if he doesn't have a great quarterback, then, you know, the offense is going to suck. You're going to get all this other stuff. I'm tired of seeing this, in part because I fought these battles in 2012, telling people things were going to turn the corner in 2013 as that offense matured. People didn't believe me because, oh, we got a senior quarterback now. It's going to be even worse. And this offense is so complicated that they'll never be able to run it with a freshman quarterback. Or, you know, and of course, nobody expected a freshman at that point. Nobody, you know, you think they're going to get better with Clint Trickett? I said, no, it's not going to be Trickett. It's going to be either Coker or Winston. People didn't believe that because, oh, you know, Fisher doesn't believe in playing young players. He's going to go with the older guy just because he's older. So you're hearing that about the wide receivers right now, which is, again, not true. And you think that we're just going to improve because, you know, the same players are coming back and we suck up front. They didn't suck up front in 2012. They were perfectly fine. This year, they've been pretty decent up front. They had zero tackles for loss given up against Clemson's defensive line, which is surprising, surprisingly efficient. They've got mistakes made of the nature that you would expect from a young offensive line, but certainly not the kinds of problems that you see at most places. It's just that Florida State fans are a bit spoiled and don't understand what a bad offensive line actually looks like. But you're seeing all the same kinds of criticisms that, you know, Fisher needs now. All that's changed is back in 2012, it was Fisher needs to give up the play calling to James Coley so that Coley can call something that these players can actually run because Fisher's offense is never going to be a great offense. And again, that 2012 offense was a top 15, 16 offense in the country. So go figure. And the 2010 offense was number 10. 2009 offense was, I think, number 6 or somewhere in there, maybe 9, going off of Football Outsiders' offensive efficiency metrics. So, you know, those were already quality offenses, and people were already not recognizing that. And that 2009 and 2010 offense, I mean, they were doing that with Richard Goodman. And, you know, old school at receiver. This is not with Kelvin Benjamin and Rashad Green running at wide receiver. I mean, they were top 10 offense without those guys and with Christian Ponder at quarterback. And what you're hearing is, you know, Fisher needs to give that up. Now, all that's changed is you hear, well, yeah, Fisher's offense just sucks unless he has a generational quarterback, a Heisman Trophy winner running it. Again, it's a misunderstanding of how the whole thing is based on a terrible amount, a terrible number of misunderstandings of, first of all, how Fisher's offense works. Secondly, the nature of how complicated or complex Fisher's offense is, and also a range of a number of other things. And I'll tell you right now, I'm going to go on the record. The 2016 offense is going to be a Ferrari. Whoever gets the keys to that Ferrari at quarterback is going to be walking into one of the best offensive situations anybody could walk into. I'm talking about 10 returning offensive linemen, the entire two deep, who've gotten experience because of all the injuries this year. So those injuries haven't helped this year, but, you know, they're going to be even better and deeper next year as a result of it. Dalvin Cook, Mario Pender, Jaquez Patrick in the backfield, and every wide receiver, including all that young talent that's been hurt pretty much the entire season, back on the roster. And the tight end talent, which is also very good. Whoever steps in at quarterback is going to be, just like I said in 2012, whoever steps in at quarterback in next year is going to be stepping into, they're getting the keys to a Ferrari. But I'm going to spend some more time on some of this a little bit later in the year. I don't have time to do it as much during the season, but I want to go into a little bit of some of the misunderstandings that people are bringing into their criticisms of Jimbo Fisher's offense. And I'm not going to tell you that there are no criticisms to be made. I've criticized Jimbo's offense, not only in written form or on this podcast, but I've talked to him about some of this stuff directly with him over the years. Going back to when he was an offensive coordinator before he was the head coach at Florida State, we talked about some of this stuff. And the good thing about that is I got a sense of what makes him tick, of how his offense actually works. Philosophically, where's he coming from? What is he thinking when he does this? Asking him a lot of those questions. And the great thing about Fisher is he'll talk ball with just about anybody. And as soon as he recognizes that you're actually wanting to understand how he's doing it, he'll put it all on table. So I was privileged, especially back when he was an offensive coordinator, to get a chance to have those conversations with the man, which is part of why I get so frustrated about this, because there are criticisms to be made of Jimbo Fisher as an offensive coordinator. It just so happens that most of the criticisms that I see getting made are the wrong criticisms. In many cases, they're backwards. They're exactly the opposite. So I want to go through a couple things just in terms of Jimbo Fisher's basic philosophy when it comes to offensive football. And I'm going to do this again on this podcast on a pretty regular basis, and we'll break some of these things down more in more detail over the course of time. But the number one thing I want to get in this particular podcast is one of the criticisms that you see of Fisher all the time, and that just baffles me, is this idea of Jimbo Fisher as the sort of John Gruden type, the guy who's in love with his playbook and he stubbornly sticks to what he likes, arrogantly believing that his stuff, his precious play calls, are more important than shaping things to personnel. I have no idea how anyone would ever get that concept out of watching a Jimbo Fisher offense, and particularly out of talking to him about offense and understanding how his offense works, looking through the actual playbook, understanding this stuff. It's just not the way it works. Fisher's entire philosophy runs against that. And I say philosophy, the first thing to understand is that Jimbo Fisher is not a system guy. And that's why this particular criticism is completely backward. He's not a system guy. Art Briles at Baylor is a system guy. He has a specific set of things he's going to do pretty much regardless of the personnel on his team. He's going to line his wide receivers up way outside the numbers. He's going to spread the field entirely, and he's going to run a base number of run plays. He's basically going to base out of the inside zone read, and then he's going to throw vertically, focusing on vertical routes for verts and slants and that sort of thing out of those wide receivers. He's going to run a specific system. Same thing with a guy like Kevin Sumlin at Texas A&M, pretty much a system guy. He's going to run an air raid version. Dana Holgorsen, he's an air raid guy. He runs his system. Those guys are system guys. Paul Johnson is a system guy. He's going to run and recruit for the triple option out of the flex bone regardless. You know that's what he's going to do no matter what. Jimbo Fisher is not a system guy. He's a philosophy guy. He's much more philosopher than he is engineer. Jimbo Fisher does not believe in having one system. He believes in having a flexible and multiple philosophy that can then bend and accommodate to whatever personnel he has on his roster. That's not to say that he doesn't have certain preferences. He's going to recruit for certain things. There's no doubt about that. He likes having bigger players, for example. He wants big wide receivers. You can see that in the last few recruiting classes. Now that the Florida State recruiting machine is up and running a bit more, he wants those big outside wide receivers. Kelvin Benjamin is your prototype. You look at the receivers that he had back at LSU, they were prototypical big wide receivers. He wants big wide receivers. He wants big tight ends. He wants the ability to go big personnel and then do that with fast players. He wants to have zone blocking up front for the most part, but the ability to go to gap blocking, man blocking, you know, power O, that sort of thing. So he's not going to stick to one thing. He wants his offense to have a base identity in this regard. This is what he's going to recruit towards, but he wants to have the flexibility to change that. And this is where I'm just baffled when I see people say, oh, Fisher's just stubborn and arrogant, and he just won't change his system to fit his personnel. I don't think there's a coach in the country who changes his system more to fit his personnel than Jimbo Fisher. If there's a criticism to be made about Jimbo Fisher, it's that his system is too flexible, or that his offense, we should avoid the word system with him because he doesn't run a system. It's that his offense is too flexible. And that goes all the way down to play calling and some of these other things that you can sometimes game him out of what he might want to do by alignment and different things, because he's going to try to accommodate to what the defense is showing and what the defense is going to give. So for Fisher, everything boils down to being flexible and multiple and ability and able to accommodate to personnel, to the point where each week during the season, he meets with his quarterbacks before they finalize the game plan and before they put the script in for the first plays of the first drive. You know, they script the first 15 plays of each game. He's going to sit down with the quarterback and say, "What do you feel most comfortable with this week? What did you see?" And those things are going to be the things that they're going to emphasize, because he wants his quarterbacks, his players, to do what they feel most comfortable with. And actually what they do during camp is they bring in a bunch of new stuff. They install a bunch of stuff. They install as much as anybody. And then what they do is they see what the players actually can execute. They pare that down and they say, okay, this is going to be the base of who we are this year. That changes and it flexes. The offense that Jimbo Fisher ran under Drew Weatherford was not the same as he ran under Xavier Lee. And that offense was very different from what they ran under sophomore Christian Ponder, which was entirely different from junior senior Christian Ponder, which was again a different offense from what they ran under sophomore EJ Manuel before he took over the starting job. But when he was working or when he was starting in place of an injured Ponder. And then that was a different offense than what they ran for EJ himself. And that was a completely different offense from what they ran under Jameis Winston. And that's been very different from the offense that we've seen through the majority of 2016 with Everett Golson. Very, very different setups based on personnel and particularly what the quarterback is able to do. That is number one on Fisher's in Fisher's philosophy. I'll never forget talking to him after... I guess it was the 2009 Wake Forest game that was up at Wake Forest, and Christian Ponder had been hurt for that, and so they started EJ Manuel in that game. And I remember talking to him. I talked to him about a half an hour after that game. This is back when, you know, he had all the time in the world to talk after games when he was an offensive coordinator. And I said, you know, it looked like you were running the Matt Mock offense out there, the offense that he'd run at LSU. With Matt Mock, who is not a really outstanding passer, but he was able to run the football a little bit. He had, you know, he was a good passer, but they ran at LSU that year. They ran a good bit of zone read. They ran some option stuff. They ran a lot of, it was a more limited offense in some other regards, but they ran a lot of stuff in the run game. Came over. So, you know, is that the Matt Mock package from back when you first started working with him? And he kind of laughed and he said, yeah, actually it pretty much was. And then he kind of made this aside. And he goes, you know, everybody wants to talk about, and this is again, remember when this was when Urban Meyer was at Florida, he said, you know, everybody wants to talk about what Urban's doing. You know, they're running all this stuff and how cutting edge it is. We've had that they're doing down there. We've had their whole offense as a package in our offense since like 2000, 2001. I mean, we ran it back at Auburn. We ran this stuff back at Auburn, you know, but everybody wants to talk about how that stuff's cutting edge and everything. We've been doing it for over a decade. And it was interesting to hear him say that, because that really does encapsulate a lot about Jimbo Fisher and his philosophy here. He had a flexible enough system that when EJ Manuel took over, they were able to say, okay, we haven't been doing this stuff, but we're going to go ahead and take some of those concepts. We're going to expand these couple things that we've been doing in the run game to allow for more of a running threat from the quarterback position. We're going to simplify what we're doing in the pass game this way. And now we're going to have, this is going to be our new offense for this week under EJ Manuel. Not many teams can do that. Very few offensive coordinators can do that. Now, that incidentally is the reason that you hear people talk about how expansive Jimbo Fisher's offense is, and you know, the quarterback doesn't have the grasp of the whole offense, or you know, how he needs to simplify or whatever. The fact is, the offense is expansive. He has, you know, the Urban Meyer offense as a pack, as a couple packages in his offense. But they only run, you know, 10% of the offense in any given season. It's just a matter of having things flexible enough that he can adjust and accommodate to whatever his talent allows. So if they were running the whole offense, then yeah, that criticism would be entirely valid. But they're not. What they do is they're gonna be flexible to accommodate to what their talent and their personnel allows them to do. And that to me is admirable. Now, again, you could say, well, you know, we could use a little bit more focus on some of these things. It'd be better if Fisher was more inflexible, more rigid, more attached to his playbook, and more attached to the few things that he really believes in, and forced his guys to just do those things, and didn't have quite as much stuff to pull from in terms of being able to adjust and flex and do all these other things. That's the criticism that you can make here. And I think that's potentially a valid criticism, and Fisher himself has admitted as much in the past. If you talk to him and, you know, at coaching conventions and things like that, at coaches' conferences and whatnot. So, you know, that's where you could potentially ding him, but certainly not on not being flexible enough. And also, another thing I'm going to get into, and I'm going to spit all this stuff out pretty quickly, and we'll unpack more of this over the next few weeks and really into the off season. And that's that when we go down the list of some of the other philosophical things that we're going to boil down from Jimbo Fisher's offense, it's that he believes, I'm going to go next to another piece about complexity. Here's a quote from him from a couple of years ago that I think typifies a lot of his approach here. I can teach one guy a heck of a lot easier than I can teach all 11. Again, I can teach one guy a heck of a lot easier than I can teach all 11. And this is about how he puts a little bit more responsibility, in some cases a lot more, as you get a more experienced player, a lot more, puts more responsibility on the quarterback in his offense to make pre-snap reads and to get his team into the right plays and checks and things like that than most offenses do. He does that. But he does that specifically to keep things simple for everybody else. Because he believes he can take, especially a guy that's been in the system a while, and you know, this goes back to what he told me this summer about working with Everett Golson. He said, well, we're not going to ask him to do the same stuff that we asked from Jameis. We're going to alter that. We're going to change that. We're going to reduce. We're going to ask less of him in that regard, because you can't ask all the stuff that we asked of Jameis from a guy who's just coming in like this. We'll find out what he can do, and then we'll ask him to do that. I talked about that on the preseason podcast, and that's basically what they did. You could see the accommodations and the adjustments and the different things that they did with Golson compared to EJ Manuel. But he believes in working with his quarterback and doing everything through the eyes of the quarterback to keep it as simple as possible for everybody else, and then to just work so that the quarterback understands the concepts. And this is the next thing. Fisher is big on concepts. Not on a bunch of plays. He wants to run a few concepts, whether it be, you know, the smash route combination or the curl flat combination or whatever. He's going to run a few concepts that are then going to filter through all sorts of other things, so that when he teaches one thing, he's teaching four or five things with his quarterbacks. Everything's about concepts. You learn to read the three base coverage looks, and you can work out from there, but, you know, and understand that this coverage is actually just a combination of these three, etc. You know, it's a combination of these two, or it combines these two in this way. You know, so you learn the basic concepts and you work from there. But if we're going to go through some of the other stuff, he believes in a lot of blind calls. What that means is having play calls that are not determined by trying to guess what your opponent is doing, but a play call that automatically has something to beat any possible look that your opponent might give you. So you have, instead of mirroring routes on both sides of the formation, you have, you know, a curl flat or a slant and bubble on one side, and then on the other side you have a post and an option route. And against quarters, you run it to one side. Against cover three, you might go to the other side. And then against man, you have another outlet. You know, the idea is to have something to beat any possible look built into whatever the quarterback is coming to the line of scrimmage with. That also involves coming to the line with more than one play, where you come in, you got, say, 42, 40, call in the huddle might be 42, 43 Houston. And you come to the line, 42 is one, 43 is two. All that happens is that the play switches which side is actually getting what. And the quarterback just says one or two at the line, checking based on what he sees in the secondary. Pretty easy stuff. He also, and as a part of those calls, he believes in simple one-word based calls. He doesn't believe in long play calls where, you know, you've got a bunch of syllables like what you get in the West Coast offense, with a lot of NFL offenses where, you know, you've got a 17-syllable play call. He believes in, you know, we're going to call Houston. And then you may tag that and you go Houston X comeback or Houston Z corner, something like that. But Houston is the base play, and all that you've done is you've tagged on to say that one player, say the X comeback, instead of running the post, that player's got the comeback now. So it just changes things with, again, a tag added to a one-word play that tells everybody what concepts they're going to be running across the board. And that's simple. That's, you know, gets back to the sort of thing that you can put on a poster with a picture. One picture gives you the whole play call. He believes in that. And then he believes in, as much as possible, keeping all five live. That means in the passing game, generally speaking, Jimbo Fisher is going to have, and this is part of having the ability to attack anything and not just guessing, he wants all five of his potential receivers to be live on a given play. That means no play, no base play in Jimbo Fisher's offense is designed to go to just one guy in the passing game. And of course, in the running game, yeah, you have, you know, it's designed to go to the tailback because it's being handed there. But in the passing game, no base play is designed, okay, we're going to call this play and it's going to go to this wide receiver. No, we're going to call this play, and depending on what coverage they're in, that's going to determine where we're going to go, because we don't want to lock ourselves into something that they can take away just by guessing right. So that's going to require that the quarterback read the coverage, but it also means that you have to learn fewer things. It's similar in that regard to what you see with Dana Holgorsen and some of these guys in the air raid system where they run, or Mike Leach, who might run mesh, the core play in Mike Leach's system, they might run 25 times in a game, but they rep it so many times and they've got different ways of tagging it so that it changes just slightly that they can run it 25 times, and it's a little bit different each time depending on what the coverage does. And because you've repped it a bunch of different ways against in practice, you can do it fast. And that's the other thing he really believes in. So when you're talking about all of these things, when you're talking about what you can criticize in terms of the Jimbo Fisher offense, if you don't understand all of that basic philosophical stuff, then you are basically in violation of the Chesterton's fence rule. The principle of Chesterton's fence, because you don't understand what's actually going into the play calls, so and therefore you don't have any business really critiquing or criticizing it until you understand it. Now, if you do understand that, okay, we have quarters. Put it another way: if you can't look pre-snap and go, oh, they're in quarters and an under, so that, based on this 2x2, you know, they should check into a post route, post alert to take advantage of the quarters because, you know, the corner there can't run with the outside wide receiver. If you can't do that, if you can't recognize the coverage or the front on the front end and talk about what concepts actually would be best to beat that, you have no business talking about play calling or criticizing play calling. That doesn't mean that as a fan, you have no business criticizing play calling. What it means is, as a fan, you should, if you want to be an educated fan, you should go ahead and find some resources that explain how certain things work in the game. And I can tell you, it will make the game much better and more fun to watch. It'll also mean that you'll have a better appreciation for how good an offensive mind Jimbo Fisher is. Florida State's been very lucky with him. Is he perfect? Is he infallible? No. There are definitely things that I have, going back to 2009, he and I talked after that game where I really disagreed with how they approached the game in the first half against UNC. I thought they took the wrong approach philosophically with what they did against that UNC defense in the first half. And he gave me an answer that I still don't agree with. But I understood what he was doing. I just didn't agree with it. At that point, you can make really good criticisms. You can make good critiques, and you can talk about, oh, I don't agree with this approach, or I thought this play call was bad, etc. What I don't want to see, and what frustrates me, is seeing all of the outcome-based thinking of, well, we lost, clearly our offensive coordinator sucks. Or, oh, we got shut down, clearly we got problems, you know, offensive coordinator needs to change. Or the offense is just not where it the offense is just not being run the way that it should be. That may or may not be the case, but you have no way of assessing it unless you actually understand the basis on which it is being run. You can't critique things you can't intelligently critique things you don't understand yourself. All right, that is going to do it for us today. Now, before we get out of here, just a reminder, you can follow me on Twitter at Doc Staples. Please tell a friend about this podcast, this particular episode especially. Get them listening. The more, the merrier. I'm also going to have a couple t-shirts available to buy for those of you who want to further support this podcast coming here in the next couple weeks. So definitely be on the lookout for that. Rate this podcast and subscribe on iTunes. Help us out with that. Definitely download the Seminole Sports Radio app and follow at Seminoles Radio for the latest on FSU sports. And of course, make sure to catch our next podcast where we're going to talk about actually Jimbo Fisher and the possibility that he could be looking elsewhere in this offseason with some of the jobs that are on the market or could come on the market. And we'll evaluate whether or not he actually would consider any of those things. So make sure to tune in for that. We'll continue to talk about more philosophical stuff as well. I'm Jason Staples. This has been the Unconquered Podcast on Seminole Sports Radio of eSporto Channel. Thanks for listening. I made this.